Nuclear reactors and children's health. The nuclear industry likes to claim that living near a nuclear power reactor is perfectly safe, that there is no danger because the annual exposure rate to radiation is too small to count. But then you learn of a European-based compilation of studies that revealed the risks, especially to small children, of developing leukemia as a result of living close to a nuclear reactor. And the man who crunched the data tells you,
with childhood leukemias, it's always led me to be more and more sure that my initial premise was right. For that reason, I'm quite happy about sticking close to the evidence, because that evidence really does show that there are increased leukemias near nuclear reactors.
Well, when you hear something like that from an impeccable international expert like Dr. Ian Fairley, you know that you are sitting in a seat that all of us share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we take a close-up look at the work of Dr. Ian Fairley. He published an article in 2014 that correlated more than 60 separate international studies about health risks to small children living within 5 kilometers, that's about 3 miles, of nuclear reactors. He not only reveals the results of that study, but explains why the greatest danger from nuclear reactors comes in a very short period of time, and how the nuclear industry intentionally kept that information from the public. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, and more honest nuclear information than the current President of the United States slept through at a recent televised cabinet meeting. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, December 2nd, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting off here in the U.S., where it should come as no surprise that many Americans are worried that the U.S. is heading for nuclear war in the next decade. This is confirmed by a new survey conducted by YouGov.com. The poll, released last week, the day before Thanksgiving, found that 46% of surveyed Americans believe a nuclear war involving the U.S. is on the horizon. 57% of Democrats and 37% of Republicans say it's likely within the next decade. And among independents, 44% say that the chances of a U.S.-involved nuclear conflict are likely. Similarly, 44% of Democrats and 46% of Republicans say terrorists or criminals could set off a nuclear weapon in the U.S. within the next decade. About 37% of independents agree. The YouGov survey was conducted from October 30th to November 2nd. Interesting that it included Halloween. Putting meat on the bones of that story is this one from TheHill.com on Nuclear Arms Race is Back and It's Testing U.S. Power. The return of nuclear weapons to the center of international politics is one of the most consequential outcomes of the resurgence of major power rivalries. The problem is not just that nuclear arsenals are expanding. It is also that the geopolitical environment that once helped manage nuclear risks has eroded. We're going to link to this article, which is from TheHill.com, a news site with the stated mission of nonpartisan reporting on the inner workings of government and the nexus of politics and business. Sources have confirmed that its reputation as a nonpartisan news organization is justified. We will link to this article on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 753. And in case we don't have enough nuclear things to worry about in terms of international safety, here's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
Did you know that you can get ChatGPT or other AI programs to help you build a nuclear bomb? The trick is to design the prompt in the form of a poem. This according to a new study from researchers in Europe. According to the research, AI chatbots have guardrails that prevent them from answering questions about child sexual abuse, revenge porn, malware, and nuclear weapons. These programs are built with guardrails that prevent them from answering questions where the information is deemed dangerous. But researchers found that it's easy to confuse those guardrails by adding adversarial suffixes to a prompt. Basically, a bunch of extra junk added to a question that confuses the AI and bypasses its safety systems. One researcher said, "We experimented by reformulating dangerous requests in poetic form, using metaphors, fragmented syntax, oblique references. The results were striking, with success rates up to 90%, and these were on requests that were immediately refused in direct form, but accepted when disguised as verse." Thankfully, the study release did not include any examples of the jailbreaking poetry, and researchers said that the verse is too dangerous to share with the public. So if there's going to be a nuclear end of the world, it just might happen in rhyme. For example, knowing how to build nukes is a crime, but AI can outthink in real time. Just prompt your banned query in poetry, dearie, and the words lead to explosive rhyme. Is that what might be called poetic justice? And that's why, to the brainiacs behind AI with its potential to reveal life on Earth-ending information, you, all of you, are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
And one additional point on nuclear war dangers is an article from thebulletin.org, from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, Post-Truth Disasters, We're Not Ready for Nuclear War on Social Media. It goes into the danger of disinformation, right-wing conspiracy theories, AI-doctored visuals and videos to support the falsehoods, and posts that include incorrect claims to expertise and contrarian fake news. Unfortunately, it has been shown that this false information is that which is most likely to capture the attention of the public, while genuine experts on urban disaster response, hazardous materials, military capabilities, and the Middle East faced stiff, platform-driven headwinds against clearing up falsehoods and sharing urgent and important information. Again, this is an article we will link to because the many parallels it makes between the nuclear vulnerabilities and what has already been seen in the aftermath of earthquakes, hurricanes, and how it would likely play out in a nuclear situation are all covered in great and alarming detail. Shifting over to more reactor-based news, the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection has ruled that Holtec International, the company in charge of dismantling the Pilgrim nuclear power plant, cannot dump its chemically and radioactively contaminated wastewater into the protected and productive waters of Cape Cod Bay, in violation of Massachusetts law, the Ocean Sanctuary Act. Holtec had argued that the wastewater was not waste under the meaning of the Ocean Sanctuaries Act. The discharge is pre-existing and therefore exempt.
Proposed discharge is associated with the production and distribution of electricity, and therefore exempt. And that the Massachusetts Ocean Sanctuary Act is preempted by the U.S. Atomic Energy Act of 1954. When asked if the dog ate their homework, they declined to respond. This is not the first time that Holtec has tried to wriggle out of its responsibilities to people and the environment. In fact, that is their reputation and their history. There's an excellent article we are going to link to, again from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, on how Holtec International became an expanding and controversial nuclear power. It started as a producer of nuclear waste storage canisters and built an empire around mothballed nuclear power plants and as yet incomplete nuclear initiatives, all of which came attached with a lot of available money, which Holtec has been hoovering up. As stated in the article, the firm's history of overpromising and underdelivering raises a question. Is this who we should trust with the future of nuclear energy? Again, we will link to this article. It is well worth your time to read it. Holtec is also involved with a harebrained scheme to restart the long-shuttered Palisades nuclear power plant in Michigan. Now, two nuclear engineers with nearly a century of combined relevant experience have warned the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff and the agency's Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards that one or more degraded steam generator tubes at the Palisades Atomic Reactor on Michigan's Lake Michigan shoreline are at high risk of failure within a short period of time after the previously closed nuclear power plant undergoes an impending, unprecedented restart. However, the documents containing the warnings have not been publicly released by NRC staff or the ACRS. These engineers are Arne Gunderson, with 54 years of relevant nuclear engineering experience, and Alan Blind, another nuclear engineer with more than 40 years of nuclear engineering experience, who has long been critical of the Palisades restart. Both serve as expert witnesses for the coalition of groups trying to hold off this recommissioning of the decommissioned reactor, a group which includes Beyond Nuclear, Don't Waste Michigan, Michigan's Safe Energy Future, the Nuclear Energy Information Service of Chicago, and 3 Mile Island Alert of Pennsylvania. That's another link on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under episode number 753. And when we try to figure out what is throttling nuclear power development is actually, surprise, the nuclear industry itself. Here's Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
Most, if not all of us, have at some point encountered someone who we'd like to have throttled. In theory only, I hasten to add. But the Trump executive order issued in May, accusing the US Nuclear Regulatory Commission of throttling nuclear power development, was definitely one of this year's bigger laugh-out-loud moments. Throttling? Really? I've known quite a few lapdogs over the years, and even owned two, and none of them throttled anything. Shredded a toy or two, maybe, but it took them months, but not throttled. Thus, it was heartening to read in an E&E News article recently that the hesitation by major nuclear power companies to invest in new plants is, quote, throttling Trump administration plans to reassert U.S. nuclear leadership globally. So there we have it. What's actually throttling nuclear power is the nuclear power industry itself. I wouldn't build a nuclear plant, Calvin Butler, CEO of Exelon, told E&E. We still need to figure out what we're going to do with cost overrun protection and how we're going to protect our investors and our customers from overruns, said Duke CEO Harry Sideris. Nothing going forward until we have those other items resolved. Nothing going forward. An energy lobbyist confided, there's not a single company out there talking about a brand new light water reactor, and that's where the administration gets frustrated. Here's what else puts utilities off new nuclear projects, according to the article, and I quote, "The utility sector is grappling with a laundry list of nuclear concerns. It's worried about high costs, hits to balance sheets, and the availability of enriched uranium in the US following a cutoff from Russian imports in 2028. Utility CEOs are also skeptical that the capital-intensive power will be needed if demand forecasts contract. We'll see if those Russian imports really do end, because so far, uranium has been exempted from any import ban, and the Russians still make the only high-assay, low-enriched uranium fuel needed for several of the new American small reactor designs. All of this stands as a powerful contradiction to the endless drumbeat of propaganda about a new nuclear renaissance, forgetting that the last one was an almighty flop, and the preposterous fast track that the Trump administration claims will deliver scores of new reactors in just a few years' time. Those startups, as we've mentioned on this show before, are being advanced by a bunch of tech bros, along with former Trump Energy Secretary Rick Perry and his son, who have been lavishing attention, gifts, and most importantly, money on Trump like some sort of spa day for his ego. As we mentioned last week, one of those pet projects they're all paying for is the giant White House ballroom. But as Evan Halper wrote in a Washington Post article last week, the favors Trump has been handing out to the young startups, or should we call them upstarts, have significantly boosted confidence in their own success, even though their projects are untested, woefully lacking in safety and sound science, and no one has signaled that they actually want to buy them. Nevertheless, Trump's embrace of these reckless mirages has also catapulted many of these startup executives into the echelons of the super wealthy and stimulated Wall Street interest, even though there is absolutely nothing behind the arras. As Halper wrote of another micro-reactor startup, Oklo, the company has become, quote, a darling of Wall Street speculators despite zero revenue and no licensed reactors. Using Perry's company Fermi as an example, Halper described how support from Trump, quote, will help Fermi turn from a glossy, aspirational marketing brochure into a cutting-edge nuclear operation. He went on to say that, quote, Trump-connected companies with untested business plans are brimming with cash infusions and winning regulators' favor. Those regulators, we must now remember, have been stacked in industry's favor with the addition of a fifth and final NRC commissioner, plucked from industry, with history working for both Holtec and Westinghouse. That change, along with the considerable attrition of qualified personnel at the NRC, has been met with glee by startup executives such as Jacob DeWitt of Oklo, he of the golf ball photo op inside the Oval Office. DeWitt proclaimed in Halper's article that while NRC officials rejected their design application the first time with what he claimed was a threatening and retributional way, well, they're gone now, he said. This is, of course, all by design, not accident. But despite all the puff-chested bragging, these new kids on the block don't even impress those who favour nuclear power. Chris Kiefer of Canadians for Nuclear Energy told Halper that the precocious startup boys, quote, assume there is something shiny, new and fancy just waiting for a Steve Jobs of nuclear. It is creating valuations that are probably wildly out of touch with what these companies are capable of. Yes, I said he was pro-nuclear. So it's all going to come crashing down, and probably sooner rather than later. Trump will have his gold baubles and his ballroom, and we probably won't have any new nuclear power plants. That last part, at least, will finally deliver some good news. And yet, even as the young pups he's embracing are getting fabulously wealthy on a wing and a prayer, Trump himself is actually investing in Westinghouse and its old established full-size reactors. Not personally, of course. He's gambling with $80 billion of our money that in turn is part of $332 billion provided to the US by the Japanese government for energy projects as part of a $500 billion end run around tariffs. So no risk there for Trump's personal millions if that too goes belly up. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
Over to Japan, which has approved the restart of the world's largest nuclear power plant. Tokyo Electric Power Company's, TEPCO's, Kashiwazaki Kariwa Nuclear Power Plant. The approval is widely seen as a symbolic milestone for Japan and the clearest indication yet that the country is returning to nuclear energy. In the wake of Catherine Bigelow's blockbuster film, A House of Dynamite, which raised awareness of the possibility of a nuclear attack on the United States coming from North Korea, two pieces of not very good news out of that country. First, at a forum hosted by the Korea Institute for Defense Analysis, it was revealed that Pyongyang likely possesses between 127 and 150 nuclear weapons, more than double the figures commonly cited by other global institutes. And North Korea's nuclear arsenal could grow to around 200 weapons by 2030 and surpass 400 by 2040. The other is that the North Korean military today is developing one of the most rapidly advancing, survivable, and operationally flexible nuclear ICBM forces on Earth, and that these systems are being built to defeat U.S. early warning systems, missile defense, and political will. What this news points to is that North Korea can nuke the continental United States now. And speaking as someone who lives on the west coast of this country, very concerning. And China has warned the United States that it would resolutely counter the proposed Golden Dome missile defense system, saying it undermines its legitimate security interests. The Trump administration is advancing the Golden Dome initiative to protect the U.S. homeland, a plan that includes space-based interceptors and sensors. But the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which forms the basis for international space law, prohibits the placement of nuclear weapons or other weapons of mass destruction in outer space, including in orbit around Earth or on celestial bodies. The treaty establishes that space should be used for peaceful purposes and is not subject to national appropriation. While China has expressed opposition to Golden Dome, in proposals for the 15th five-year plan unveiled last month, the country pledges to, quote, strengthen strategic deterrence capabilities and safeguard global strategic balance and stability. Translation: the move was interpreted as a sign that China expects to narrow the nuclear arsenal gap with the U.S. and Russia. According to a report published by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute in June, China has around 600 nuclear warheads and is adding about 100 new warheads a year and has been since 2023. In contrast, it is estimated that the U.S. has a total inventory of 5,177 warheads, of which 3,700 are in military stockpiles, while Russia has 5,459, of which 4,309 are in military stockpiles. All of these bombs are magnitudes larger and more powerful than the ones that leveled Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the explosion of even a single one of these in space could set up an electromagnetic pulse capable of flattening the power grid. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, well, it's December, officially the start of the holiday season, when we think about giving. And gifts come in all forms. My weekly gift to you is Nuclear Hot Seat, bringing you up to date on nuclear issues around the world and empowering activist response to it. Part of the mission statement of Nuclear Hot Seat is to keep those individuals and organizations that oppose nuclear in good heart. And that's what I seek to do. Guests this year alone have included activists, physicists, attorneys, medical doctors, epidemiologists, engineers, downwinders, authors, filmmakers, anyone and everyone of interest I could find who is fighting against some aspect of the nuclear industrial complex. It's my honor and privilege to be able to talk with people such as this week's guest, ask them all the questions I can, and then share their answers with listeners literally around the world. But producing this show takes more than just time and energy. It requires money. And like so much of the rest of the world at this time of year, that's what I'm reaching out to you about. If you listen to Nuclear Hot Seat and find that you get value from it and want it to continue, now is the time to help. This show runs exclusively on donations and cannot survive without your support. So in the spirit of the season, if you are grateful for the information you get here, now is the time to help us out. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. And we make it easy for you. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and follow the prompts. Or you can send your donation directly through Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Be it a one-time donation or monthly recurring, you'll be supporting the services required to keep this program running. So please, don't wait. Go now to nuclearhotseat.com to donate and keep our nuclear news online. Know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. Over the past weekend, I attended a 3-day non-nuclear event. Yes, such things do exist. As a result, I know that I have a lot of new listeners. So here's a cornerstone interview from 2014 with Dr. Ian Fairley. He is a UK-based Canadian consultant on radiation in the environment and a former member of the three-person secretariat to Britain's committee examining the radiation risks of internal emitters. Ian is a radiation biologist who has focused on the radiological hazards of nuclear fuel and has studied radioactive releases at nuclear facilities since before the Chernobyl accident in 1986. In 2014, the date of this interview, he published a scientific paper that blew the lid off the nuclear industry's claim that living near a reactor is perfectly safe. He also shows how the industry's standard operating procedures kept that information from the public until 2012. Please note, with my apologies, that at one point near the beginning of our talk, Skype became more Skype-ish than usual, and there's an echo on the line. I've edited it out as best I can, and if you bear with it through that brief bumpy zone, the problem eventually resolves. Trust that the information is well worth it.
Ian Fairley, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Let's start out with giving people an idea of your background.
My main degree is in radiation biology. In other words, the effects of radiation on cells and tissues. Before that, I was a chemist at University of Western Ontario in Canada. My postgraduate studies were in how best to deal with radioactive waste. And that was at Imperial College here in London. After that, I entered the civil service and worked for the Department of Environment in the UK government for about 10 years, I suppose. And after that, I retired. But during my previous, life, before I started studying radiation biology, I actually worked for Greenpeace Canada as a science advisor to them on their various campaigns. So you could say I've had a pretty rounded sense of experience in terms of both an academic and a civil servant and also a Greenpeace campaigner.
It seems that scientists like to consider themselves outside of politics, at least when they are putting forward the information that they do. Do you consider yourself anti-nuclear as a political stance?
Yes. Basically what it is that a long time ago I became fairly certain that the increased leukemias that we see in the near-nuclear power station came from their discharges. And I thought that it was unconscionable, just totally wrong for kiddywinkers, little kids, to be dying from leukemia because of us generating electricity. There's lots of other ways of generating electricity. And I suppose fair to say that I'm not really very much in favor of nuclear power. But having said that, I'm also a scientist. And for scientists, the most important thing is to stick close to the evidence. In other words, if the evidence points in a certain direction, then check the evidence. Make sure it's the best evidence. And if that means you have to change your views, so be it. But with childhood leukemias, It's always led me to be more and more sure that my initial premise was right. So for that reason, I'm quite happy about being sticking close to the evidence, because that evidence really does show that there are increased leukemias near nuclear reactors.
To be clear, you did not do a study on the childhood leukemias showing up around nuclear power plants, but you did compile existing studies and existing statistics. How extensive were those, and what led you to take this particular approach?
Well, to actually carry out an epidemiological study takes a lot of time and a lot of money, and you have to have access to a lot of data. And oftentimes that data is proprietary, and you can't get it yourself. You have to rely on other people getting it and giving it to you. On the other hand, there were over 60 studies worldwide on this particular issue of childhood leukemias near nuclear power plants. And that in itself provided enough data for me to do my work properly. And 60 studies is a lot of studies, and there was a lot of data in those studies. And so that was by far the best thing to do, was to mine the existing data rather than actually carrying out a study from de novo, so to speak, using new data.
Explain to us the extent of the danger that you discovered in doing this compilation of existing research.
By the way, I should say that I collaborated in a lot of this with a German scientist called Dr. Alfred Kurblein, and he will crop up a lot in my work. What we found when we were doing this work together was, first of all, the large number of studies. I mean, 60 studies worldwide. In toxicology, this is probably one of the biggest areas that has ever been studied. For example, if you were to look at asbestos or chemicals or lead poisoning or anything like that, there's nowhere near 60 studies on health effects from particular plants. So this is a very large number. The second thing is that we could do what are called meta-analysis. In other words, what you do is you, by careful examination of the data, you can add the data together. You've got to be sure that you're adding oranges to oranges and not apples and oranges, but you can do it. And when we've done that, you can get meta-analysis. Other people have done the same, by the way, and they all come up with the same answer, and that is that there are increased leukemias near nuclear power stations. The thing is, it's beyond doubt. There's a very clear pattern of raised childhood leukemias near nuclear power stations.
There was one aspect in the article that you did cite where you combined the statistics, apparently oranges to oranges, for Germany, Great Britain, Switzerland, and France into a single table. I was struck by the fact that what you came up with was 37% increase in childhood leukemias within 5 kilometers, which is about 3 miles, from almost all nuclear power plants in these countries.
That's right.
Why had no one thought to compile these statistics before, and how alarming is this to you as a result that came from this?
Well, the first thing is that the four governments, the scientists in those governments obviously knew that this was going on, and they always obviously knew that each of the four countries were doing this. It's an obvious step for the data and the four studies to be added together, and I'm absolutely positive that the scientists, the relevant scientists in the four countries did it. In fact, we know them, and we know they did it, but they didn't publish the data. We did, and Dr. Kurblein and I, we did it together, very statistically significant increases in childhood leukemias near all the reactors in those four countries. Not quite all the reactors. In France, there was only about 2/3 of the reactors, but pretty well all of the reactors in the four countries.
What conclusions can be drawn, or did you draw, from the compilation that you put together?
Well, it was quite clear that there was an increase. It was beyond the bounds of chance. This wasn't a fluke finding. This meant that it was clear that there were increases near NPPs, and that we had to move on to the reasons for that and the energy policy consideration.
When did you start this?
The actual study itself was commissioned by the organizers of a conference in the UK in 2012, and myself and many other contributors to the conference. All the proceedings of the conference were going to be published in the journal. The problem was that my article or my talk was very controversial. It resulted in a lot of delay in the peer review process. And as a result of that, the proceedings of the conference delayed by about 2 years.
I understand that there was one scientist who shall remain nameless who challenged you repeatedly and extensively. Would you talk about what that was like for you and also how you responded to the various challenges that you received?
The person concerned that I've known for many years, he's a worthy adversary, shall we say. I have a lot of respect for his work, funny enough. He's a good scientist, but we have different views about nuclear power. And it was a real tussle, shall we say. A long, drawn-out, gladiatorial battle. But it was on the basis of science, and we argued the toss about scientific evidence. And that took a long time, over many pages of paper, and many, many points. The editor of the journal, he was very good. He had to be a neutral referee in this, but he was well-informed. He knew about the issues, and he knew what to allow, what not to allow. And so my congratulations go to him. A lot of other people would have ducked out on this, but he saw it right through. And in the end, he published it. And his reward is that as a result of the publication, within about 2 or 3 months, about 500 people downloaded it, which in this, shall I say, narrow subject area, is a lot of downloads. It's gone viral, or partly viral. A good chunk of the readership of the Journal of Environmental Radioactivity must have downloaded the article. And for the editor, that is very heartening, because that means he struck a chord, and people are picking up on what he's published. So he was very happy indeed. There is one other thing I should mention, and that is that I waited for about 3 months after the publication before I went onto the web and with my own blog on this. And that is to give time to readers to point out any errors or omissions or bits for a better wall or whatever may be in the article. And to date, touch wood, there haven't been any at all. So that's given me a lot of confidence in the sense that even although I can imagine a lot of readers will be find this difficult to take, they haven't come up with anything which has sunk me below the waterline, so to speak. A shell hasn't landed below the waterline or anything like that. In fact, there haven't been any shells. So I'm quite pleased with that, and I'm relatively confident with the hypothesis now.
It seems that the extensive challenges that you went through with your worthy scientific opponent helped you vet the article to the point where nobody could pick anything apart with it. How accurate would that be?
That would be very true. Yes, you're right. The fact that the peer review process was so tough basically meant that the article itself was pretty watertight.
Now that we have this watertight article that correlates raised leukemia rates in children with proximity to nuclear power plants, what impact has what you've written had on public awareness in the media and on governmental policy?
Well, it's really hard to say. What I do know is that amongst my colleagues and friends here in the UK and in Germany, they've more or less taken this on board, and it's now accepted, certainly in the environmental community, that this is a serious matter that has to be taken on board, and that building nuclear power stations really is very problematic now. As far as governments are concerned, now they deny it all the way. It's very difficult for them, if they've decided that they're going down the nuclear line, to find this evidence which directly contradicts it. they reject the evidence, unfortunately.
What do you think is going to happen here in the United States as more and more people become aware of this article and have the opportunity to read it?
That's a good question. In the United States, right now, the National Research Council is about to embark on a big study of childhood cancers near U.S. reactors. And this is going to be quite important. There's about 100 reactors in the United States, and if you get data for all those 100, that's going to be a fairly powerful study. Now, what this study that I've produced says that in the rest of the world, the evidence is crystal clear. There are increased leukemias near nuclear plant. So I'm pretty sure that government scientists in the United States will have read the article. Indeed, given that the fact that there's been so many downloads, and the consultant that looks after my website says a good chunk of those, like about half, are from the United States, that means that the scientists who count in the United States may know about the study, for sure. So that, say, 200, 300 scientists in the United States have downloaded this and have read it, they must be aware in government circles of this article, and it must figure somehow or other in their thinking. I'm not sure whether they will like the article in the sense that it's bad news for them, particularly in the Department of Energy in the United States, but nevertheless, the evidence is there. There is one other thing, and that is that the United States Environmental Protection Agency is consulting on proposals to relax the limits for radiation doses from U.S. nuclear power stations. This study flies right in the face of that. It says, if anything, it should be the other way around. It should be tightening, not relaxing, radiation limits near U.S. reactors. So there's two things going on in the United States right now. Both of them are addressed by my article, and it's difficult for me to predict what's actually going to happen. I have a number of friends in the United States, quite a few in fact, and they have said to me that they are surprised and amazed at the findings in my study. They say that it has clear implications for what's going on in the United States. So my reaction would be, while the jury's still out, watch this space. Let's see what happens.
To what extent do you think it would be possible for the U.S. to put together a study this massive and somehow come up with different results than what you came up with in examining 60 other studies?
Well, the first thing is that if they do what we did, in other words, we restricted this to children under 5, and also the exposure area to less than 5 kilometers, i.e. under 3 miles, it would be extremely surprising if they found anything different than we found. The reactors that we're talking about are the similar reactors to the United States, the pressurized water reactors and boiling water reactors. So it would be very difficult. One of the key things I'd like to mention to your listeners is this. Up until 2012, we didn't really know what happened with emissions from nuclear reactors. The only data that we had was annual data, so many becquerels or petabecquerels or gigabecquerels per annum from a reactor. We didn't really know the time pattern. Now we do. Now we know that the large majority, say two-thirds, three-quarters, of the annual emissions from a reactor occur just once, during one spike. And that spike occurs when the reactor is opened up to take out the old fuel and to put in fresh fuel. And during that time period, about a day, day and a half, the reactors are depressurized. In other words, the huge pressures inside the reactor are, well, they open up the valves and the radioactive gases shoot out. It's during that time that we think that the people downwind are exposed to high levels of radioactivity, i.e. high radiation doses. And that phenomenon, in other words, that time signature. Instead of having even little bits of emissions throughout the 365 days, now you don't have that. You have one big massive spike, which happens over about a day and a half period. And that happens, roughly speaking, about once a year, when the fuel rods are taken out, the old ones, and the new ones are put in. So that's important, very, very important, because it results in doses which are at least 20 times higher, maybe even as much as 100 times higher. I discussed this in my article. So that's a major worry, and that's something that's going to have to be addressed by both the US EPA and also the National Research Council in its future studies. They're going to have to address this big spike in emissions each year from every reactor.
That's stunning because, of course, by averaging out over a year, it seems like it would be a much lower thing.
Dose.
You wouldn't have to worry about it. It wouldn't be a dose that would be damaging, low level, blah, blah, blah. But what you're saying is that the majority of that happens at a predictable time when the fuel rods are being switched out and there is no notice, no awareness, no
Correct.
Sirens going off, no protection, no
Correct.
Awareness.
Correct. Indeed, I've said to a number of nuclear operators, look, why don't you do this at nighttime when people are in bed? Mm-hmm. Why don't you do it when it's really, really windy out and it's not raining and the rain brings the radionuclides clouds back to Earth? When it's windy, you get massive dispersion. But if it's very calm, then it just drifts everywhere and you get big doses, no response. Libby, there's one other thing a little story I'd like to tell you, which might interest your readers. This time pattern, these spikes, have been hidden from us ever since the beginning of the nuclear power program back in the 1950s, or late 50s, early 60s. Nobody knew about them, apart from the people who worked in the nuclear industry, and they kept really quiet about it. What happened was that some German scientists who were anti-nuclear began to suspect that there was something funny going on here. So back in 2012, when the regional government of Baden-Württemberg became red-green. By red-green, I mean it was governed by a coalition of socialist and green parties, rather than the, how shall I say, the Christian Democrats, who are sort of more conservative in their views. The first thing they did was this German red-green coalition, was that they demanded their nuclear regulator give them data, give the minister, the energy minister, data on the half-hourly emissions from the nuclear power plants in their area, in Baden-Württemberg. This is intriguing. The energy minister was a woman. I'm afraid I've forgotten her name, and I haven't got it written down, but she was a very powerful and determined lady. And the head of the region's nuclear regulatory commission refused to give the information and said, no, we don't have it. But from an insider, we knew that they did have it. And so the German energy minister said, you will put this data on my desk on Monday morning or you will be fired. And he said, I don't believe you. She said, right, I want on my desk on Friday afternoon your resignation letter, undated. And he had to bring his letter, resignation letter, undated, and she put it in the drawer and said, right, if I don't get this information on Monday morning, I am putting a date on this letter. That's what she did. In other words, she was playing hardball. We got the data. But the trouble is that the data was presented in a computer program format that nobody had, apart from the nuclear industry. So we demanded the data in a sort of user-friendly form, and they said, no, you asked for the data, you got it. We're not helping you anymore. And she was about to sack the regulator when some people in the Green Party who were computer wizards said, look, we can put this data into a computer program, shall we call it A, and then transfer that to computer program B, and then transfer it to Microsoft Excel. And once we get it into Excel, we can read off the data. It took them about 3 days to do it, but they got it.
I love it.
And we got the data, and for the first time we saw what was happening, a massive spike, 1,000 times higher in terms of concentration than the normal amount. In other words, instead of 3 becquerels per cubic meter, we're finding 3,000 becquerels per cubic meter. In other words, a 1,000-fold increase. And then we knew what was going on, and then we knew, because they had hit this since the start of the nuclear power program. Well, that's like 50 years ago. They've hidden this, and it went to great lengths to prevent us from getting the information. And now we've got it. Now, what I'd like to say to your American listeners is this is very important. You have to go to your regulators and say, there's no reason why this is not occurring also in UK and US reactors. These data are from pressurized water reactors at Gundremmingen in Baden-Württemberg in Germany. And so we know that it's very, very likely the same is happening with US reactors. So what are you going to do about it? That's the wake-up call that I'd like to issue to your listeners. And I hope that at least some of your listeners will pick this up and say, whoa, we've got to do something here.
It's a powerful piece of information. And the fact that they knew, that the industry knew about these spikes and went to such great lengths to hide it, means that they understood exactly how devastating that information would be to their business and their financial futures. So, of course, they would do everything in their power to hide it. And good for those people in Germany and that environmental minister and you for getting this information, putting it in a usable form so that we have the opportunity to now use this as a very important piece of weaponry, as it were, on behalf of getting these things shut down and taken care of. So if someone hears this interview or reads your article and realizes that they are living in proximity to a nuclear reactor and they either have or they want to have children, what would you recommend that they do?
I've already done this in Canada, in fact, where they've got nuclear reactors, you wouldn't believe, in metropolitan Toronto. It's absolutely crazy. I'm Canadian, so I don't have any joy in saying what I say, but the Ontario government really has got to get a grip of this. And I have said in guidance to Greenpeace Canada that women of childbearing age who wish or intend to have families, or even if they've got young ones, or if they're already pregnant, they shouldn't live within 10 kilometers of a reactor. And that people who already live near nuclear reactors and have gardens, they shouldn't eat their own produce if they live within 5 kilometers. And I've actually given that evidence, and it's published on my website in evidence to Greenpeace Canada. So my advice would be to young women who are living in the shadow of nuclear reactors is don't do it.
Ian, if people wish to download a complete copy of your article, how could they do that?
Difficult. It's behind a very stiff paywall. My guidance to people who need a full copy for research purposes would be to contact me, and it's permissible under the copyright laws to send individual copies to scientific researchers. You can do that. What is not permissible is for somebody to get a copy, then immediately send it around to hundreds of other people. That is not allowed, I'm afraid, under our present copyright arrangements. For those people who are not scientific researchers, my guidance to them would be, do they know anybody who works as a scientist in an academic institution, a university in the United States? Or do they live near a big national library, either in Washington, D.C. or New York or L.A. or near the Lawrence Livermore Laboratories or the Berkeley Laboratories or any of the National Research Institutes, because they will have copies of these journals, and they will have a copy of the Journal of Environmental Radioactivity online. So if they have any friends in universities at all, they will be able to get them, ask them to download for them. It's not ideal. The present paywall arrangements are unfortunate, but it's how the large publishing companies make their living. So that's my best guidance.
Ian, anything you would like to add at this point that we haven't covered?
I haven't mentioned the name of the organization in Germany which got the data of the emission spikes. It's called IPPNW, and that stands for International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, IPPNW. They're a large international organization based, their headquarters are in Boston, in Massachusetts. They're a good organization. My hats go off to IPPNW because they were the people that got the data.
And IPPNW also provided me with Dr. Alex Rosen, who,
yes,
in Nuclear Hot Seat number 161, I had the opportunity,
yes,
to interview him about the UNSCEAR report, which,
yes,
he took apart point by point. It has gone viral. It has been picked up by ENE News and elsewhere and has become one of the most important interviews that I have done. This one ranks up there as well because,
right,
what you're providing us is with the hardcore scientific evidence that we can use to say we're not a bunch of emotional tree-hugging environmentalists, though we may be in our spare time. But we also have the data to back up what it,
absolutely,
is that we are saying.
My study provides a lot of ammunition. It really does. And try and get a hold of it. And if there are people who desperately, who really do need to have this, for example, they have children who live very close to a nuclear reactor, I will send them the article, I will, so that they can use it to obtain some sort of redress. I have given evidence in Canada to various public hearings, governmental inquiries and stuff like that. And I'm quite prepared to do that in the United States. Here I am, ready, willing, and able to help out in any way that I can for the forthcoming, there's two struggles now. One is the National Research Council study, and secondly is the US EPA proposals to weaken the safety limits.
Ian, thank you so much for sharing your time and your expertise with the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby. It's a pleasure from mine, and best wishes to all the campaigners who are opposing the nuclear juggernaut, as you say, in the United States. And I'd like to say to you, too, well done, and I hope that we can certainly keep in touch.
Dr. Ian Fairley. Since we recorded this interview, he has co-written a book with Cindy Folkers of Beyond Nuclear. It's entitled, The Scientists Who Alerted Us to the Dangers of Radiation. The book chronicles attempts by scientists to warn about radiation risks going back to the 1920s. It's about what they learned, how they tried to get their information out, and how their voices were silenced. We will have a link up to the book and also some of Dr. Fairley's articles on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 753. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, December 2nd, 2025. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, December 2nd, 2025. Want to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week? It's easy. Just sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel or cut to the chase and help us out. Go to NuclearHotSeat.com, look for the yellow opt-in box, put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get an email from us with a link and a short description to that show's content. And speaking of content, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@NuclearHotSeat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Today may be Giving Tuesday, but any day of any week of any month is a good time for you to give us some support. Any amount will help us out, and we really appreciate you for helping us to keep going. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, ignoring the negative impact of nuclear radiation on our lives and health doesn't change the scientific facts or lessen what it is doing to harm us. It just keeps us trapped in the danger. So, hello there! Pay attention! There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.